L. That is just the mass of the electron multiplied by its velocity, multiplied by the radius of its orbit, or simply L equals mvr. There were no limits in classical physics on the angular momentum of an electron or any other object moving in a circle. When Bohr read Nicholson's paper, he found his former Cambridge colleague arguing that the angular momentum of a ring of electrons could change only by multiples of h over 2 pi, where h is Planck's constant and pi is the well-known numerical constant from mathematics, 3.14, etc. Nicholson showed that the angular momentum of a rotating electron ring could only be h over 2 pi or 2 h over 2 pi or 3 h over 2 pi or 4 h over 2 pi all the way to n h over 2 pi, where n is an integer, a whole number. For Bohr, it was the missing clue that underpinned his stationary states. Only those orbits were permitted in which the angular momentum of the electron was an integer n multiplied by h and then divided by 2 pi, letting n equal 1, 2, 3, and so on, generated the stationary states of the atom in which an electron did not emit radiation and could therefore orbit the nucleus indefinitely. All other orbits, the non-stationary states were forbidden. Inside an atom, angular momentum was quantized. It could only have the values L equals NH over 2 pi and no others. Just as a person on a ladder can stand only on its steps and nowhere in between, because electron orbits are quantized, so are the energies that an electron can possess inside an atom. For hydrogen, Bohr was able to use classical physics to calculate its single electron's energy in each orbit. The set of allowed orbits and their associated electron energies are the quantum states of the atom, its energy levels, En. The bottom rung of this atomic energy ladder is N equals 1 when the electron is in the first orbit, the lowest energy quantum state. Bohr's model predicted that the lowest energy level, E1, called the ground state for the hydrogen atom, would be negative 13.6 eV, where an electron volt, eV, is the unit of measurement adopted for energy on the atomic scale, and the minus sign indicates that the electron is bound to the nucleus. If the electron occupies any other orbit but N equals 1, then the atom is said to be in an excited state. Later called the principal quantum number, N is always an integer, a whole number, which designates the series of stationary states that an electron can occupy and the corresponding set of energy levels, En, of the atom. Bohr calculated the values of the energy levels of the hydrogen atom and found that the energy of each level was equal to the energy of the ground state divided by N squared, E1 over N squared EV. Thus, the energy value for N equals 2, the first excited state, is negative 13.6 over 4 equals negative 3.40 EV. The radius of the first electron orbit, N equals 1, determines the size of the hydrogen atom in the ground state. From his model, Bohr calculated it as 5.3 nanometers, where a nanometer is a billionth of a meter, in close agreement with the best experimental estimates of the day. He discovered that the radius of the other allowed orbits increased by a factor of n squared. When n equals 1, the radius is r. When n equals 2, then the radius is 4r. When n equals 3, the radius is 9r, and so on. I hope very soon to be able to send you my paper on the atoms, Bohr wrote to Rutherford on 31st of January, 1913. It has taken far more time than I had thought. I think, however, that I have made some progress in it in the latest time. He had stabilized the nuclear atom by quantizing the angular momentum of the orbiting electrons and thereby explained why they could occupy only a certain number, the stationary states of all possible orbits. Within days of writing to Rutherford, Bohr came across the third and final clue that allowed him to complete the construction of his quantum atomic model. Hans Hansen, a year younger and a friend of Bohr's from their student days in Copenhagen, had just returned to the Danish capital after completing his studies in Göttingen. When they met, Bohr told him about his latest ideas on atomic structure. Having conducted research in Germany in spectroscopy, the study of the absorption and emission of radiation by atoms and molecules, Hansen asked Bohr if his work shed any light on the production of spectral lines. It had long been known that the appearance of a naked flame changed color depending on which metal was being vaporized. Bright yellow with sodium, deep red with lithium, and violet with potassium. In the 19th century, it had been discovered that each element produced a unique set of spectral lines, spikes in the spectrum of light. The number, spacing, and wavelengths of the spectral lines produced by the atoms of any given element are unique. A fingerprint of light that can be used to identify it. Spectra appeared far too complicated given the enormous variety of patterns displayed by the spectral lines of the different elements for anyone to seriously believe that they could be the key to unlocking the inner workings of the atom. The beautiful array of colors on a butterfly's wing were all very interesting, Bohr said later, but nobody thought that one could get the basis of biology from the coloring of the wing of a butterfly. There was, obviously, a link between an atom and its spectral lines, but at the beginning of February 1913, Bohr had no inkling what it could be. Hansen suggested that he take a look at Balmer's formula for the spectral lines of hydrogen. As far as Bohr could remember, he had never heard of it. More likely, he had simply forgotten it. Hansen outlined the formula and pointed out that no one knew why it worked. Johann Balmer was a Swiss mathematics teacher at a girls' school in Basel and a part-time lecturer at the local university. Knowing that he was interested in numerology, a colleague told Balmer about the four spectral lines of hydrogen after he had complained about having nothing interesting to do. Intrigued, he set out to find a mathematical relationship between the lines where none appeared to exist. The Swedish physicist Anders Engström had, in the 1850s, measured the wavelengths of the four lines in the red, green, blue, and violet regions of the visible spectrum of hydrogen with remarkable accuracy. Labeling them alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, respectively, he found their wavelengths to be 656.210, 486.074, 434.01, and 410.12 nanometers. In June 1884, as he approached 60, Balmer found a formula that reproduced the wavelengths, lambda, of the four spectral lines. Lambda equals B, M squared over M squared negative N squared, in which M and N are integers and B is a constant, a number determined by experiment as 364.56 nanometers. Balmer discovered that if N was fixed as 2, but M set equal to 3, 4, 5, or 6, then his formula gave an almost exact match for each of the four wavelengths in turn. For example, when N equals 2 and M equals 3 is plugged into the formula, it gives the wavelength of the red alpha line. However, Balmer did more than just generate the four known spectral lines of hydrogen, later named the Balmer series in his honor. He predicted the existence of a fifth line when N equals 2 but M equals 7, unaware that Engström, whose work was published in Swedish, had already discovered and measured its wavelength. The two values, experimental and theoretical, were in near-perfect agreement. Had Engström lived, he died in 1874, aged 59, he would have been astounded by Balmer's use of his formula to predict the existence of other series of spectral lines for the hydrogen atom in the infrared and the ultraviolet regions by simply setting N to 1, 3, 4, and 5 while letting M cycle through different numbers, as he had done with N set at 2 to generate the four original lines. For example, with N equals 3 and M equals 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, Balmer predicted the series of lines in the infrared that were discovered in 1908 by Friedrich Paschen. Each of the series forecast by Balmer was later discovered, but no one had been able to explain what lay behind the success of his formula. What physical mechanism did the formula, arrived at through a process of trial and error, symbolize? As soon as I saw Balmer's formula, Bohr said later, the whole thing was immediately clear to me. It was electrons jumping between different allowed orbits that produce the spectral lines emitted by an atom. If a hydrogen atom in the ground state, N equals 1, absorbs enough energy, then the electron jumps to a higher energy orbit, such as N equals 2. The atom is then in an unstable, excited state and quickly returns to the stable ground state when the electron jumps down from N equals 2 to N equals 1. It can do so only by emitting a quantum of energy that is equivalent to the difference in energy of the two levels, 10.2 eV. The wavelength of the resulting spectral line can be calculated using the Planck-Einstein formula, E equals HV, where V is the frequency of the emitted electromagnetic radiation. An electron jumping from a range of higher energy levels to the same lower energy level produced the four spectral lines of the Balmer series. The size of the quanta emitted depended only on the initial and final energy levels involved. This was why Balmer's formula generated the correct wavelengths when N was set equal to 2, but M was 3, 4, 5, or 6 in turn. Bohr was able to derive the other spectral series predicted by Balmer by fixing the lowest energy level that the electron could jump to. For example, transitions ending with the electron jumping to N equals 3 produced the passion series in the infrared, while those that ended at N equals 1 generated the so-called Lyman series in the ultraviolet region of the spectrum. There is, as Bohr discovered, a very strange feature associated with an electron's quantum leap. It is impossible to say where an electron actually is during a jump. The transition between orbits, energy levels, has to occur instantaneously. Otherwise, as the electron traveled from one orbit to another, it would radiate energy continuously. In Bohr's atom, an electron could not occupy the space between orbits. As if by magic, it disappeared while in one orbit and instantly reappeared in another. I'm fully convinced that the problem of spectral lines is intimately tied to the question of the nature of the quantum. Remarkably, it was Planck in February 1908 who wrote these words in a notebook. But in his ongoing struggle to minimize the impact of the quantum and before the Rutherford atom, it was as far as Planck could go. Bohr embraced the idea that electromagnetic radiation was emitted and absorbed by atoms in quanta. But in 1913, he did not accept that electromagnetic radiation itself was quantized. Even 6 years later, in 1919, few believed in Einstein's quantum of light when Planck declared in his Nobel Prize lecture that Bohr's quantum atom was the long-sought key to the entrance gate into the wonderland of spectroscopy. On 6th of March 1913, Bohr sent Rutherford the first of a trilogy of papers and asked him to send it on to the Philosophical Magazine. At the time, and for many years to come, every junior scientist like Bohr needed someone of Rutherford's seniority to communicate a paper to a British journal to ensure swift publication. "I am very anxious to know what you may think of it all," he wrote to Rutherford. He was particularly concerned about the reaction to his mixing of the quantum and classical physics. Bohr did not have to wait long for the answer. "Your ideas as to the mode of origin of spectra in hydrogen are very ingenious and seem to work out well, but the mixture of Planck's ideas with the old mechanics make it very difficult to form a physical idea of what is the basis of it all." Rutherford, as others would, was having trouble picturing how the electron in the hydrogen atom jumped between energy levels. The difficulty lay in the fact that Bohr had violated a cardinal rule of classical physics. An electron moving in a circle is an oscillating system, with one complete orbit being an oscillation, and the number of orbits per second being the frequency of oscillation. An oscillating system radiates energy at the frequency of its oscillation, but since two energy levels are involved in an electron making a quantum jump, there are two frequencies of oscillation. Rutherford was complaining that there was no link between these frequencies, between the old mechanics and the frequency of the radiation emitted as the electron jumps between energy levels. He also identified another more serious problem. There appears to me one grave difficulty in your hypothesis, which I have no doubt you fully realize. Namely, how does an electron decide what frequency it is going to vibrate at when it passes from one stationary state to the other? It seems to me that you would have to assume that the electron knows beforehand where it is going to stop. An electron in the N equals 3 energy level can jump down to either the N equals 2 or N equals 1 levels. In order to make the jump, the electron appears to know to which energy level it is heading so that it can emit radiation of the correct frequency. These were weaknesses of the quantum atom to which Bohr had no answer. There was another more minor criticism that concerned Bohr far more deeply. Rutherford thought the paper really ought to be cut down, since long papers have a way of frightening readers who feel that they have not time to dip into them. After offering to correct Bohr's English where necessary, Rutherford added a postscript. I suppose you have no objection to my using my judgment to cut out any matter I may consider unnecessary in your paper? Please reply. When Bohr received the letter, he was horrified. For a man who agonized over the choice of every word and went through endless drafts and revisions, the idea that someone else, even Rutherford, would make changes was appalling. 2 weeks after posting the original paper, Bohr sent a longer revised manuscript containing alterations and additions. Rutherford agreed that the changes were excellent and appear quite reasonable, but he once again urged Bohr to cut the length. Even before he received this latest letter, he wrote to Rutherford telling him that he was coming to Manchester on holiday. When Bohr knocked on the front door, Rutherford was busy entertaining his friend Arthur Eve. He later recalled that Rutherford immediately took the slight-looking boy into his study, leaving Mrs. Rutherford to explain that the visitor was a young Dane and her husband thought very highly indeed of his work. Through hour after hour of discussions over several long evenings during the days that followed, Bohr admitted that Rutherford showed an almost angelic patience as he tried to defend every word in his paper. An exhausted Rutherford finally gave in, and afterwards began regaling his friends and colleagues with tales of the encounter. I could see that he had weighed up every word in it, and it impressed me how determinedly he held on to every sentence, every expression, every quotation. Everything had a definite reason, and although I first thought that many sentences could be omitted, it was clear, when he explained to me how closely knit the whole was, that it was impossible to change anything. Ironically, Bohr admitted years later that Rutherford had been right in objecting to the rather complicated presentation. Bohr's trilogy was published virtually unchanged in the Philosophical Magazine as On the Constitution of Atoms and Molecules. The first, dated 5th of April 1913, appeared in July. The second and third parts, published in September and November, were a presentation of ideas concerning the possible arrangements of electrons inside atoms that would preoccupy Bohr for the next decade as he used the quantum atom to explain the periodic table and the chemical properties of the elements. Bohr had built his atom using a heady cocktail of classical and quantum physics. In the process, he had violated tenets of accepted physics by proposing that electrons inside atoms can occupy only certain orbits, the stationary states. Electrons cannot radiate energy while in those orbits. An atom can be in only one of a series of discrete energy states, the lowest being the ground state. Electrons can somehow jump from a stationary state of high energy to a stationary state of low energy, and the difference in energy between the two is emitted in a quantum of energy. Yet, his model correctly predicted various properties of the hydrogen atom, such as its radius, and it provided a physical explanation for the production of spectral lines. The quantum atom, Rutherford said later, was a triumph of mind over matter, and until Bohr unveiled it, he believed that it would require centuries to solve the mystery of the spectral lines. A true measure of Bohr's achievement was the initial reactions to the quantum atom. It was discussed publicly for the first time on 12th of September 1913 at the 83rd annual meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, BAAS, held that year in Birmingham. With Bohr in the audience, it received a muted and mixed reception. J.J. Thomson, Rutherford, Rayleigh, and Jeans were all there, while the distinguished foreign contingent included Lorentz and Curie. Men over 70 should not be hasty in expressing opinions on new theories, was Rayleigh's diplomatic response when pressed for his opinion about Bohr's atom. In private, however, Rayleigh did not believe that nature behaved in that way, and admitted that he had difficulty in accepting it as a picture of what actually takes place. Thomson objected to Bohr's quantization of the atom as totally unnecessary. James Jeans begged to differ. He pointed out in a report to the Pact Hall that the only justification that Bohr's model required was the very weighty one of success. In Europe, the quantum atom was greeted with disbelief. "This is all nonsense. Maxwell's equations are valid under all circumstances," said Max von Laue during one heated discussion. "An electron in a circular orbit must emit radiation." While Paul Ehrenfest confessed to Lorentz that Bohr's atom has driven me to despair. "If this is the way to reach the goal," he continued, "I must give up doing physics." In Göttingen, Bohr's brother Harald reported that there was great interest in his work, but that his assumptions were deemed too bold and fantastic. One early triumph for Bohr's theory clinched the support of some, including Einstein. Bohr predicted that a series of lines found in the spectrum of light from the sun that had been attributed to hydrogen actually belonged to ionized helium, with one of its two electrons removed. This interpretation of the so-called Pickering-Fowler lines was at odds with that of its discoverers. Who was right? The issue was settled by one of Rutherford's team in Manchester after a detailed study of the spectral lines instigated at the behest of Bohr. Just in time for the BAAS meeting in Birmingham, it was found that the Dane had been correct in his assignment of the Pickering-Fowler lines to helium. Einstein heard the news during a conference in Vienna at the end of September from Bohr's friend Georg von Hevesy. "The big eyes of Einstein," reported Hevesy in a letter to Rutherford, "looked still bigger, and he told me, 'Then it is one of the greatest discoveries.'" By the time Part 3 of the trilogy was published in November 1913, another member of Rutherford's group, Henry Moseley, had confirmed the idea that the nuclear charge of an atom, its atomic number, was a unique whole number for a given element and the key parameter that decided its position within the periodical table. It was only after Bohr visited Manchester in July that year and spoke to Moseley about the atom that the young Englishman began shooting beams of electrons at different elements and examined the resulting X-ray spectra. By then it was known that X-rays were a form of electromagnetic radiation with wavelengths thousands of times shorter than those of visible light, and that they were produced when electrons with sufficient energy struck a given metal. Bohr believed that X-rays were emitted because one of the innermost electrons was knocked out of an atom, and an electron moved down from a higher energy level to fill the vacancy. The difference in the two energy levels was such that the quantum of energy emitted in the transition was an X-ray. Bohr realized that, using his atomic model, it was possible to determine the charge of the nucleus using the frequencies of the emitted X-rays. It was this intriguing fact that he had discussed with Moseley. With a prodigious capacity for work matched only by his stamina, while others slept, Mosley stayed in the laboratory working through the night. Within a couple of months, he had measured the frequencies of X-rays emitted by every element between calcium and zinc. He discovered that as the elements he bombarded got heavier, there was a corresponding increase of frequencies of the emitted X-rays. Mosley predicted the existence of missing elements with atomic numbers 42, 43, 72, and 75 on the basis that each element produced a characteristic set of X-ray spectral lines, and those adjacent to each other in the periodic table had very similar ones. All four were later discovered, but by then, Mosley was dead. When the First World War began, he enlisted in the Royal Engineers and served as a signals officer. He died, shot through the head, in Gallipoli, on 10th of August, 1915. His tragic death at the age of 27 robbed him of a certain Nobel Prize. Rutherford personally gave him the highest possible accolade. He hailed Mosley as a born experimenter. Bohr's correct assignment of the Pickering-Fowler lines and Mosley's groundbreaking work on nuclear charge were beginning to win support for the quantum atom. A more significant turning point in its acceptance came in April 1914, when the young German physicists James Franck and Gustav Hertz bombarded mercury atoms with electrons and found that the electrons lost 4.9 eV of energy during these collisions. Franck and Hertz believed they had succeeded in measuring the amount of energy required to rip an electron from a mercury atom. Not having read his paper due to the initial widespread skepticism that greeted it in Germany, it was left to Bohr to provide the correct interpretation of their data. When the electrons fired at the mercury atoms had energies of less than 4.9 eV, nothing happened. But when a bombarding electron with energy above 4.9 eV scored a direct hit, it lost that amount of energy and the mercury atom emitted an ultraviolet light. Bohr pointed out that 4.9 eV was the energy difference between the ground state of the mercury atom and its first excited state. It corresponded to an electron jumping between the first two energy levels in the mercury atom, and the energy difference between these levels was exactly as predicted by his atomic model. When the mercury atom returns to its ground state, as the electron jumps down to the first energy level, it emits a quantum of energy that produces an ultraviolet light of wavelength 253.7 nanometers in the mercury line spectra. The Franck-Hertz results provided direct experimental evidence for Bohr's quantized atom and the existence of atomic energy levels. Despite initially having misinterpreted their data, Franck and Hertz were awarded the 1925 Nobel Prize in Physics. Just as part one of the trilogy was published in July 1913, Bohr had finally been appointed to a lectureship at Copenhagen University. Before long, he was unhappy, as his major responsibility was to teach elementary physics to medical students. At the beginning of 1914, with his reputation on the rise, Bohr set about trying to establish a new professorship in theoretical physics for himself. It would be difficult, as theoretical physics as a distinct discipline was still poorly recognized as such outside Germany. In my opinion, Dr. Bohr is one of the most promising and able of the young mathematical physicists in Europe today, wrote Rutherford in the testimonial to the Department of Religious and Educational Affairs in support of Bohr and his proposal. The immense interest that his work had attracted internationally ensured that Bohr received the backing of the faculty, but once again the university hierarchy chose to postpone any decision. It was then that a dejected Bohr received a letter from Rutherford offering an escape route. I dare say you know Darwin's tenure of readership has expired and we are now advertising for a successor at £200, Rutherford wrote. Preliminary inquiries show that not many men of promise are available. I should like to get a young fellow with some originality in him. Having already told the Dane that his work showed great originality and merit, Rutherford wanted Bohr without explicitly saying so. In September 1914, having been granted a year's leave of absence, as any decision on the professorship he wanted was unlikely before then, Niels and Margrethe Bohr arrived in Manchester to a warm welcome at their safe arrival after a stormy voyage around Scotland. The First World War had begun, and much had changed. The wave of patriotism that swept the country had virtually emptied the laboratories as those eligible to fight signed up. The hope that the war would be short and sharp receded by the day as the Germans smashed through Belgium and into France. Men who had only recently been colleagues were now fighting on opposing sides. Marsden was soon at the Western Front. Geiger and Hevesy had joined the armies of the Central Powers. Rutherford was not in Manchester when Bohr arrived. He had left in June to attend the annual meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, being held that year in Melbourne, Australia. Recently knighted, he visited his family in New Zealand, before traveling on to America and Canada as planned. Once back in Manchester, Rutherford devoted much of his time to anti-submarine warfare. Since Denmark was neutral, Bohr was not allowed to take part in any war-related activities. He concentrated largely on teaching, and what research was possible was impeded by the lack of journals and the censorship of letters from and to Europe. Originally planning to spend just a year in Manchester, Bohr was still there when in May 1916 he was formally appointed to the newly created post of Professor of Theoretical Physics in Copenhagen. The growing recognition of his work had secured the post, but despite its successes there were problems that the quantum atom could not solve. The answers it gave for atoms with more than one electron failed to tally with experiments. It could not even account for helium with just two electrons. Worse, Bohr's atomic model predicted spectral lines that could not be found. In spite of the introduction of ad hoc selection rules to explain why some lines were observed and others were not, all the central elements of Bohr's atom were accepted by the end of 1914. The existence of discrete energy levels, the quantization of angular momentum of the orbiting electrons, and the origin of spectral lines. However, if there existed a single spectral line that could not be explained, even with the imposition of some new rule, then the quantum atom was in trouble. In 1892, improved equipment appeared to show that the red alpha and blue gamma Balmer lines of the hydrogen spectrum were not single lines at all, but were each split in two. For more than 20 years it remained an open question whether these lines were true doublets or not. Bohr thought not. It was at the beginning of 1915 that he changed his mind as new experiments revealed that the red, blue, and violet Balmer lines were all doublets. Using his atomic model, Bohr could not explain this fine structure, as the splitting of the lines was called. As he settled into his new role as a professor in Copenhagen, Bohr found a batch of papers waiting for him from a German who had solved the problem by modifying his atom. Arnold Sommerfeld was a 48-year-old distinguished professor of theoretical physics at Munich University. Over the years, some of the most brilliant young physicists and students would work under his watchful eye as he turned Munich into a thriving center of theoretical physics. Like Bohr, he loved skiing and would invite students and colleagues to his house in the Bavarian Alps to ski and talk physics. "But let me assure you that if I were in Munich and had the time, I would sit in on your lectures in order to perfect my knowledge of mathematical physics," Einstein had written to Sommerfeld in 1908, while still at the patent office. It was some compliment coming from a man described as a lazy dog by his maths professor in Zurich. To simplify his model, Bohr had confined electrons to move only in circular orbits around the nucleus. Sommerfeld decided to lift this restriction, allowing electrons to move in elliptical orbits, like the planets in their journey around the sun. He knew that, mathematically speaking, circles were just a special class of ellipse. Therefore, circular electron orbits were only a subset of all possible quantized elliptical orbits. The quantum number n in the Bohr model specified a stationary state, a permitted circular electron orbit, and the corresponding energy level. The value of n also determined the radius of a given circular orbit. However, two numbers are required to encode the shape of an ellipse. Sommerfeld therefore introduced k, the orbital quantum number, to quantize the shape of an elliptical orbit. Of all the possible shapes of an elliptical orbit, k determined those that were allowed for a given value of n. In Sommerfeld's modified model, the principal quantum number n determined the values that k could have. If n equals 1, then k equals 1. When n equals 2, k equals 1 and 2. When n equals 3, k equals 1, 2, and 3. For a given n, k is equal to every whole number from 1 up to and including the value of n. When n equals k, the orbit is always circular. However, if k is less than n, then the orbit is elliptical. For example, when n equals 1 and k equals 1, the orbit is circular with a radius r called the Bohr radius. When n equals 2 and k equals 1, the orbit is elliptical, but n equals 2 and k equals 2 is a circular orbit with a radius 4r. Thus, when the hydrogen atom is in the n equals 2 quantum state, its single electron can be in either the k equals 1 or k equals 2 orbits. In the n equals 3 state, the electron can occupy any one of three orbits. N equals 3 and k equals 1, elliptical. N equals 3 and k equals 2, elliptical. N equals 3 and k equals 3, circular. Whereas in Bohr's model, n equals 3 was just one circular orbit, in Sommerfeld's modified quantum atom, there were three permitted orbits. These extra stationary states could explain the splitting of the spectral lines of the Balmer series. To account for the splitting of the spectral lines, Sommerfeld turned to Einstein's theory of relativity. Like a comet in orbit around the sun, as an electron in an elliptical orbit heads towards the nucleus, its speed increases. Unlike a comet, the speed of the electron is great enough for its mass to increase as predicted by relativity. This relativistic mass increase gives rise to a very small energy change. The n equals 2 states, the two orbits, k equals 1 and k equals 2, have different energies because k equals 1 is elliptical and k equals 2 circular. This minor energy difference leads to two energy levels that yield two spectral lines where only one was predicted by Bohr's model. However, the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantum atom was still unable to explain two other phenomena. In 1897, the Dutch physicist Peter Zeeman discovered that in a magnetic field, a single spectral line split into a number of separate lines or components. This was called the Zeeman effect, and once the magnetic field was switched off, the splitting disappeared. Then, in 1913, the German physicist Johannes Stark found that a single spectral line splits up into several lines when atoms are placed in an electric field. Rutherford contacted Bohr as Stark published his findings. "I think it is rather up to you at the present time to write something on the Zeeman and electric effects, if it is possible to reconcile them with your theory." Rutherford was not the first to ask. Soon after the publication of Part 1 of his trilogy, Bohr had received a letter of congratulations from Sommerfeld. "Will you also apply your atomic model to the Zeeman effect?" he asked. "I want to tackle this." Bohr was unable to explain it, but Sommerfeld did. His solution was ingenious. Earlier, he had opted for elliptical orbits and thereby increased the number of possible quantized orbits that an electron could occupy when an atom was in a given energy state, such as n equals 2. Bohr and Sommerfeld had both pictured orbits, whether circular or elliptical, as lying in a plane. As he tried to account for the Zeeman effect, Sommerfeld realized that the orientation of an orbit was the vital missing component. In a magnetic field, an electron can select from more permitted orbits pointing in various directions with respect to the field. Sommerfeld introduced what he called the magnetic quantum number m to quantize the orientation of those orbits. For a given principal quantum number n, m can only have values that range from negative n to n. If n equals 2, then m has the values negative 2, negative 1, 0, 1, 2. I do not believe ever to have read anything with more joy than your beautiful work, Bohr wrote to Sommerfeld in March 1916. The orientation of electron orbits, or space quantization as it became known, was experimentally confirmed 5 years later in 1921. It made available extra energy states, now labeled by the three quantum numbers N, K, and M, which an electron could occupy in the presence of an external magnetic field, leading to the Zeeman effect. Necessity being the mother of invention, Sommerfeld had been forced to introduce his two new quantum numbers K and M to explain facts revealed by experiments. Leaning heavily on the work of Sommerfeld, others explained the Stark effect as resulting from the changes in the spacing between energy levels due to the presence of an electric field. Although there were still weaknesses, such as the inability to reproduce the relative intensity of the spectral lines, the successes of the Bohr-Sommerfeld atom further enhanced Bohr's reputation and earned him an institute of his own in Copenhagen. He was on his way to becoming, as Sommerfeld called him later, the director of atomic physics through his work and the inspiration he gave others. It was a compliment that would have pleased Bohr, who had always wanted to replicate the way in which Rutherford had run his laboratory and the spirit he had succeeded in creating among all those who worked there. Bohr had learnt more than just physics from his mentor. He saw how Rutherford was able to galvanize a group of young physicists into producing their best. In 1917, Bohr set out to replicate what he had been fortunate enough to experience in Manchester. He approached the authorities in Copenhagen about establishing an institute for theoretical physics at the university. The institute was approved, as friends raised the money necessary for buildings and land. Construction began the following year, soon after the end of the war, at a site on the edge of a beautiful park not far from the city center. Work had only just begun when a letter arrived that unsettled Bohr. It was from Rutherford, who was offering him a permanent professorship in theoretical physics back in Manchester. "I think the two of us could try and make physics boom," wrote Rutherford. It was tempting, but Bohr could not leave Denmark just as he was about to be given everything that he wanted. Maybe if he had gone, Rutherford would not have left Manchester in 1919 to take over from J.J. Thomson as the director of the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge. Always known as the Bohr Institute, the Universitäts Institut för Teoretisk Fysik was formally opened on 3rd March 1921. The Bohrs had already moved into the 7-room flat on the first floor with their growing family. Following the upheavals of war and the hardship of the years that followed in its wake, the Institute was soon the creative haven Bohr hoped it would be. It quickly became a magnet for many of the world's brightest physicists. But the most talented of them all would always remain an outsider. Chapter 5. When Einstein Met Bohr. "Those are the madmen who do not occupy themselves with quantum theory," Einstein told a colleague as they looked out of the window of his office in the Institute of Theoretical Physics at the German University in Prague. After his arrival from Zurich in April 1911, he had been puzzled as to why only women used the grounds in the morning and only men in the afternoons. As he struggled with his own demon, he discovered that the beautiful garden next door belonged to a lunatic asylum. Einstein was finding it difficult to live with the quantum and the dual nature of light. "I wish to assure you in advance that I am not the orthodox light quantizer for whom you take me," he told Hendrik Lorentz. It was a faulty impression that arose, he claimed, "from my imprecise way of expressing myself in my papers." Soon he gave up even asking if quanta really exist. By the time he returned from the first Solvay conference in November 1911 on the theory of radiation and the quanta, Einstein had decided that enough was enough and pushed the lunacy of the quantum to one side. Over the next 4 years, as Bohr and his atom took center stage, Einstein effectively abandoned the quantum to concentrate on extending his theory of relativity to encompass gravity. Founded in the mid-14th century, Prague University was divided in 1882 along lines of nationality and language into two separate universities, one Czech and the other German. It was a division that reflected a society where Czechs and Germans harbored a deep-seated suspicion and mistrust of each other. After the easygoing, tolerant atmosphere of Switzerland and the cosmopolitan mix of Zurich, Einstein was ill at ease in spite of the full professorship and the salary that enabled him to live in some comfort. It provided just a quantum of solace against the creeping sense of isolation. By the end of 1911, as Bohr contemplated his move from Cambridge to Manchester, Einstein desperately wanted to return to Switzerland, and it was then that an old friend came to his rescue. Recently appointed as the dean of the mathematics and physics section of the Swiss Federal Technical University, ETH, Marcel Grossmann offered Einstein a professorship in Zurich at the renamed former Polytechnic. Although the job was his, there were formalities that Grossmann had to observe. High on the list was seeking the advice of eminent physicists about Einstein's possible appointment. One of those asked was France's premier theorist, Henri Poincaré, who described Einstein as one of the most original minds he knew. The Frenchman admired the ease with which he adapted to new concepts, his ability to see beyond classical principles, and when faced with a physics problem, he promptly envisages all possibilities. Where Einstein had once failed to get a job as an assistant, in July 1912 he returned as a master physicist. It was inevitable that sooner rather than later Einstein would become a prime target for the men in Berlin. In July 1913, Max Planck and Walter Nernst boarded the train to Zurich. They knew that it would not be easy to persuade Einstein to return to a country he had left almost 20 years ago, but they were prepared to make him an offer he simply could not refuse. As Einstein met them off the train, he knew why Planck and Nernst had come, but not the details of the proposal they were about to make. Having just been elected a member of the prestigious Prussian Academy of Sciences, he was being offered one of its two salaried positions. This alone was a great honor, but the two emissaries of German science also offered a unique research professorship without any teaching duties, and the directorship of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Theoretical Physics once it was established. He needed time to mull over the unprecedented package of three jobs. Planck and Nernst went on a short sightseeing train ride as he considered whether or not to accept. Einstein told them that they would have his answer when they returned by the color of the rose he carried. If red, he would go to Berlin. If white, he would stay in Zurich. As they got off the train, Planck and Nernst knew they had got their man when they saw Einstein clutching a red rose. Part of the lure of Berlin for Einstein was the freedom to give myself over completely to rumination with no obligations to teach. But with it came the pressure of having to deliver the sort of physics that made him the hottest property in science. "The Berliners are speculating with me as with a prize-winning laying hen," he told a colleague after his farewell dinner. "But I don't know if I can still lay eggs." After celebrating his 35th birthday in Zurich, Einstein moved to Berlin at the end of March 1914. Whatever reservations he might have had about returning to Germany, he was soon enthusing, "Intellectual stimulation abounds here. There is just too much of it." The likes of Planck, Nernst, and Rubens were all within easy reach. But there was another reason why he found odious Berlin exciting. His cousin, Elsa Löwenthal. 2 years earlier, in March 1912, Einstein had begun an affair with the 36-year-old divorcee with two young daughters, Ilse, aged 13, and Margot, 11. "I treat my wife like an employee whom I cannot fire," he told Elsa. Once in Berlin, Einstein would often disappear for days without a word of explanation. Soon, He moved out of the family home altogether and drew up a remarkable list of conditions under which he was willing to return. If Mileva accepted his terms, she would indeed become an employee, and one her husband was determined to fire. Einstein demanded, 1. That my clothes and laundry are kept in good order and repair. 2. That I receive my 3 meals regularly in my room. 3. That my bedroom and my office are always kept neat, in particular that the desk is available to me alone. Further, she was to renounce all personal relations and refrain from criticizing him either in word or deed in front of my children. Finally, he insisted that Mileva adhere to the following points. 1. You are neither to expect intimacy from me nor reproach me in any way. 2. You must desist immediately from addressing me if I request it. 3. You must leave my bedroom or office immediately without protest if I so request. Mileva agreed to his demands, and Einstein returned. But it could not last. At the end of July, after just 3 months in Berlin, Mileva and the boys went back to Zurich. As he stood on the platform waving goodbye, Einstein wept, if not for Mileva and the memories of what had been, then for his 2 departing sons. But within a matter of weeks he was happily enjoying living alone in my large apartment in undiminished tranquility. It was a tranquility that few would enjoy as Europe descended into war. One day the great European war will come out of some damned foolish thing in the Balkans, Bismarck was once reported as saying. That day was Sunday, 28 June, 1914, and it was the assassination in Sarajevo of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the crowns of Austria and Hungary. Austria, supported by Germany, declared war on Serbia. Germany declared war on Serbia's ally Russia on 1st of August, and on France 2 days later. Britain, who guaranteed Belgian independence, declared war on Germany on the 4th of August after it had violated Belgium's neutrality. Europe in its madness has now embarked on something incredibly preposterous, Einstein wrote on 14 August to his friend Paul Ehrenfest. While Einstein felt only a mixture of pity and disgust, Nernst, at 50, volunteered as an ambulance driver. Planck, unable to contain his patriotism, declared, "It is a great feeling to be able to call oneself a German." Believing that it was a glorious time to be alive, as rector of Berlin University, Planck sent his students to the trenches in the name of a just war. Einstein could hardly believe it when he discovered that Planck, Nernst, Röntgen, and Wien were among the 93 luminaries who signed the Appeal to the Cultured World. This manifesto was published on 4th of October 1914 in leading German newspapers and in others abroad. Its signatories protesting against the lies and defamations with which our enemies are trying to besmirch Germany's pure cause in the hard life-and-death struggle forced upon it. They asserted that Germany bore no responsibility for the war, had not violated Belgian neutrality, and had committed no atrocities. Germany was a cultured nation to whom the legacy of Goethe, Beethoven, and Kant is fully as sacred as its hearths and plots of land. Planck quickly regretted having signed, and in private began apologizing to his friends among foreign scientists. Of all those that lent their names to the falsehoods and half-truths of the Manifesto of the 93 as it became known, Einstein had expected better from Planck. Even the German Chancellor had publicly admitted that Belgium's neutral status had been violated. "The wrong that we are committing we will endeavor to make good as soon as our military goal is reached." As a Swiss citizen, Einstein was not asked to add his signature. However, he was deeply concerned at the long-term effect of the unbridled national chauvinism of the manifesto and was involved in producing a counter-manifesto entitled An Appeal to Europeans. It called on educated men of all states to ensure that the conditions of peace did not become the source of future wars. It challenged the attitude expressed by the Manifesto of the 93 as unworthy of what until now the whole world has understood by the term culture, and it would be a disaster if it were to become the common property of educated people. It castigated German intellectuals for behaving almost to a man as though they had relinquished any further desire for the continuance of international relations. However, including Einstein, there were only four signatories. By the spring of 1915, the attitudes of his colleagues at home and abroad had left Einstein feeling deeply disheartened. Even scholars of the various nations behave as if their cerebrums had been amputated 8 months ago. Soon all hope that the war would be short-lived evaporated, leaving him by 1917 constantly very depressed about the endless tragedy we must witness. Even the habitual flight into physics does not always help, he confessed to Lawrence. Yet the 4 years of war proved to be among his most productive and creative, as Einstein published a book and some 50 scientific papers, and in 1915 completed his masterpiece, General Relativity. Even before Newton, it had been assumed that time and space were fixed and distinct, the stage on which the never-ending drama of the cosmos was played out. It was an arena where mass, length, and time were absolute and unvarying. It was a theater in which spatial distances and time intervals between events were identical for all observers. Einstein, however, discovered that mass, length, and time were not absolute and unchanging. Spatial distances and time intervals depended on the relative motion of observers. Compared to his earthbound twin, for an astronaut traveling at near-light speed, time slows down. The hands on a moving clock are slower. Space contracts. The length of a moving object shrinks, and a moving object gains mass. These were the consequences of special relativity, and each would be confirmed by experiments in the 20th century, but the theory did not incorporate acceleration. General relativity did. In the midst of his struggle to construct it, Einstein said that it made special relativity look like child's play. Just as the quantum was challenging the accepted view of reality in the atomic realm, Einstein took humanity closer to understanding the true nature of space and time. General relativity was his theory of gravity, and it would lead others to the Big Bang origin of the universe. In Newton's theory of gravity, the force of attraction between two objects, such as the sun and the earth, is proportional to the product of their respective masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance separating their centers of mass. With no contact between the masses, in Newtonian physics, gravity is a mysterious action-at-a-distance force. In general relativity, however, gravity is due to the warping of space caused by the presence of a large mass. The Earth moves around the sun not because some mysterious invisible force pulls it, but because of the warping of space due to the sun's enormous mass. In short, matter warps space, and warped space tells matter how to move. In November 1915, Einstein tested general relativity by applying it to a feature of Mercury's orbit that could not be explained using Newton's gravitational theory. In its journey around the sun, Mercury does not trace out exactly the same path every orbit. Astronomers had precise measurements that revealed that the planet's orbit rotated slightly. Einstein used general relativity to calculate this orbital shift. When he saw that the number matched the data within the margins of error, he had palpitations of the heart and felt as if something had snapped inside. "The theory is beautiful beyond comparison," he wrote. With his boldest dreams fulfilled, Einstein was content, but the Herculean effort left him worn out. When he recovered, he turned to the quantum. Even as he worked on the general theory in May 1914, Einstein was among the first to grasp that the Frank-Hertz experiment was a confirmation of the existence of energy levels in atoms and a striking verification of the quantum hypothesis. By the summer of 1916, Einstein had a brilliant idea of his own about an atom's emission and absorption of light. It led him to an astonishingly simple derivation, I should say, the derivation of Planck's formula. Soon Einstein was convinced that light quanta are as good as established. However, it came at a price. He had to abandon the strict causality of classical physics and introduce probability into the atomic domain. Einstein had offered alternatives before, but this time he could derive Planck's law from Bohr's quantum atom. Starting with a simplified Bohr atom with only two energy levels, he identified three ways in which an electron could jump from one level to the other. When an electron jumps from a higher to a lower energy level and emits a quantum of light, Einstein called this spontaneous emission. It occurs only when an atom is in an excited state. The second type of quantum leap happens when an atom becomes excited as an electron absorbs a light quantum and jumps from a lower to a higher energy field. Bohr had invoked both types of quantum leap to explain the origin of atomic emission and absorption spectra, but Einstein now revealed a third, stimulated emission. It occurs when a light quantum strikes an electron in an atom that is already in an excited state. Instead of absorbing the incoming light quantum, the electron is stimulated, nudged, to leap to a lower energy, emitting a light quantum. Four decades later, stimulated emission formed the basis of the laser, an acronym for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Einstein also discovered that light quanta had momentum, which, unlike energy, is a vector quantity. It has direction.